Hello, my name is Rich Jones. I'm a co-founder of U-Turn and the Chief Clinical Officer of U-Turn Health, and I'm also a co-host of this wonderful podcast.
And my name is Liz, and I'm a co-founder of U-Turn and a co-host of You Learn, You Turn.
And let's get the show on the road.
Hi, everyone. Welcome. My name is Erin Craw, and I am a strategic account manager here at U-Turn Health, working in the public sector. We have an excellent guest today. I'm so thrilled to have you on with us and to be sharing a little bit about your story and a new project you've been working on. Welcome, Dr. Olivia Johnson. And I'd love for you to start with just talking a little bit about your very, very impressive background and history in this space and all that you've been doing over the past couple of years here.
Yeah, thanks, Erin, for having me. It's always nice to be here. So I actually am former law enforcement and former military. So through kind of my travels, I've kind of tried a little bit of everything once I got out of the military, landed kind of in the law enforcement realm for a while, and I felt really like that was where I needed to be. While I was there, sadly, the only other female in my academy class was killed in a vehicle accident. And I started looking at what was going on, why this happened. It was one vehicle accident, why she was, you know, traveling at the speed she was, not wearing a seatbelt. I started looking into those kind of things. And the more that I dug, I started realizing that there were other issues going on here in law enforcement, and that this was a known one of driving too fast for conditions, not wearing seatbelt, that kind of thing. But the more I dug, I started coming up with these cases of suicide. And I felt really compelled for a while because I felt like no one was talking about it and it was new. And I started asking my coworkers, are you aware of this? And everyone seemed dumbfounded, like they had no idea. And I just kept digging and digging. And the more I dug, the more cases I found. And I'm like, well, again, it's not, you know, statistically speaking, this isn't an epidemic, but it was definitely concerning. So I actually decided to do my dissertation in that area. And I wanted to start interviewing people and finding out how well known was this. And it actually, it was big. I mean, officers didn't know, administrators didn't know, families didn't know. And I thought, this is where I need to be. Like, I felt like this was my calling, at least to start here. This has taken us into many different directions. So let me first say that from our, you know, the research initially, I've been doing this for about 15 years. And since 2016, the end of 2016, part of 2017 is where we started a big project where I actually track and collect law enforcement and corrections officer suicide deaths. We look at murder, suicide, and then non-fatal attempts. And we are the only ones in the entire world that have this kind of database. So we actually pull autopsy, toxicology reports, police reports. We go back on social media, you know, minimum of a year per each case. And we get interviews from families, friends, coworkers. In fact, we have a psychological autopsy template that it's like another 227 questions that we ask for each case to kind of fill in the why it happened, if you will. So that's been our big project for the last about 5 or 6 years. And then we took that data. We were able to publish a book by Springer Publishers, Practical Considerations for Preventing Police Suicide. And that turned into what we're now working on, which is our Fatal 10. So I can explain that in a little bit, but that's kind of where the progression has gone. And then it's kind of spanned out from there.
Thank you. Yeah, what an incredible career path that you've had. And you can hear in your description just the immense growth that you've been such an important part of just across the entire first responder space. And so I know you mentioned the Fatal 10 and some of the things that you're working on currently. I know one of the things that you were just recently a part of was a film. And so can you tell us a little bit about just in a nutshell, what that film is, what it's about, the value of it, and why that was even a project that you wanted to be a part of.
Yeah, I was so excited too. It's called Is There Something Going On at Home? It was directed by Jason Harney and Deborah Ortiz. And the players in this, you know, Deb and her husband, Michael, their daughter, Angela, were one of the families that were interviewed. Then we have another family, Scott and Rachel Medlin. They talk about their struggles of getting through life. You know, Deb and her family talk about her husband's leaving the force and his issues with drug and alcohol addiction, how that affected their family, every one of them. Scott and Rachel share how being young parents and having a passion of being in law enforcement, as Scott was, they had to juggle that for a while and realize what's truly important here is this financially feasible for the family. And there were some real struggles there. And that's one of the struggles I think today that we have as families is, you know, you have to start weighing, is this really working for our family? Is this really what we want? Is, you know, and Scott and Rachel took a, you know, a very unique approach where they tried to make it work for a while and then eventually realized that him being in law enforcement wasn't going to work. And that was huge for at least my component of it, which I'm kind of one of the narrators and I have a smaller part, but it was huge because our fatal 10, when we looked at these 10 factors of what was leading or at least major factors in completed suicide in our data, interpersonal relationship issues was the leading issue. And that's for anyone, really. It's the issue, you know, you have coworker issues, you have issues at home, your spouse, partner, significant other, your friends, family, kids. There are things that disrupt those relationships. And these families were both struggling and they were struggling to find who they were, their self, you know, identity. They were struggling to find out what their purpose was. And we boiled our fatal 10 down and we came out to two components, which were relation. It's called relational purpose. And I think these families were both really struggling in that area. You know, they, the individuals knew that law enforcement was a passion. That's what they wanted to do. And it was kind of their purpose, but the relationships and the things that they were doing to deal with the stress and different things in their life were really starting to affect the family as a whole. And the question was, is there something going on at home? And the answer is yes. Our data shows that the majority of our cases of completed suicide, there's a small component for the job and, you know, stress and trauma. But the majority of that is stuff in the personal life and how we're dealing with that, the coping mechanisms we use. If we turn to alcohol every night or drug use, which is common in our data as well, those also have repercussions. But sadly, we have gotten to the point where we want to blame the job for everything. We want to blame the job for our bad marriage. We want to blame the job for alcohol and drug use. We want to blame it for literally everything in our life that isn't going right with no personal accountability. And I think this film really kind of brings that to light and starts shining light on that.
It sounds like, too, from your description, this value of storytelling from different perspectives that maybe is not always so accessible for people in this space, right? And I'm a family member. My father did 36 years on the job and worked various different divisions throughout my childhood. And I can attest to definitely something always going on at home, right? And so that kind of spillover effect of the cumulative stress in the day-to-day and all of those kind of what I call like the in-between moments, right? From maybe not even just a critical incident, that shift, but maybe it's the organizational stress or, right. You know, the moments that happen in between those critical incidents that we tend to fixate on a little bit more in those types of conversations about things and relating to the job and that stress. Can you talk a little bit about your perspective just in general in terms of how I know you just made a point of it's, you know, a lot of the times it becomes this almost like this blaming of the job is responsible for these things. But how from your perspective and part of this film was the conversation around, well, this is what happens when you come home from a shift, or this is what happens. I know the transition can be really challenging, right? From going to this, like, and I know Dr. Gilmartin's work, and he talks about this hypervigilance, right. The vigilance roller coaster and all of these factors. So talk a little bit, if you don't mind, about the realities of how the job does kind of spill over into those family relationships.
And it does. It does spill over, you know, especially if you just left a call or something that's got you kind of, you know, you're heightened, you got that hypervigilance, you've got that, you know, adrenaline pumping yet, and you come home and you kind of want to share, but you kind of don't, depending on what the case is. You kind of are still high on that. So when you get home, you kind of expect everyone else to kind of walk around you like, you know, you kind of own the space and everyone's just supposed to tiptoe around you. And, you know, depending on what you're coming home with, whether it be, you know, a bad accident, something involving a child, it depends really on the type of call that you had. You bring that home and you're still thinking about it. You know, if you've had a 5-minute drive home, you don't have time to process any of that. And the first thing you're probably thinking about is getting home, grabbing a beer and chilling out. You know, it's one of those, it's a coping mechanism that many of us use. It's one of those things that you just want to let your guard down for a minute. You think it's going to de-stress you. And what happens is once you get home is you start, it's drink after drink after drink. And that becomes what you go to. And it starts to change the whole personality of the family. You know, you come home and after a while, kind of it's expected of what you're going to do, how you're going to act. You know, your family's going to start realizing how much you're drinking and how it changes your personality. And over time, you know, when you come home, it just is who you are now. Everything is kind of centered around you and what you do. I know, you know, I didn't have a lot of the time in, you know, in service as far as law enforcement goes. I had 8 years military and just over 4 or 5 years in law enforcement. But, you know, it's the idea that when I came home, my stories were fun and exciting. My husband works on generators. Nobody wants to listen to that. And like, that's not fun. Like that, you know, the generator does nothing. And, you know, and if it's broken, you fix it. So it would change the way that you would talk to your spouse. And it might have started out funny, but after a while, you're like, I'm so tired of hearing about that generator you worked on. Nobody cares what color it is. Nobody cares where it's at. You know, it was just boring. So you start to tune out everybody else because what you think that they're telling you isn't as important. And it starts to really change the dynamic, especially between spouses and partners, to where they don't feel like they're being heard at all anymore.
So it sounds like, Dr. Johnson, there's like this tension between wanting to share, but also wanting this space and this almost, you know, I'm going back to Dr. Gilmartin's work here again, but that magic chair kind of concept, right? Like I want my own space. I want this place where I can just kind of have a quote unquote sanctuary location. But then I also do have this like pull to share. Am I hearing that correctly? So it's kind of this like tension between the two.
Yeah. And there's this like, it's kind of this, I don't know what the right word is to look for, but it's like this idea that you want to share some of it, but you're afraid to share too much of it. And, right. And, you know, I always tell, you know, officers, it's like, you know, when you come home after a while and you come home and you're having a bad day and you snap at somebody, they're not going to go, oh, they must have had a bad day. They'll do that for a minute. And then after a while, they're like, why are you being a jerk? And insert other word here, that will become the new narrative now is why are you being such a jerk? And you don't see it. You just think you're having a bad day. You're entitled to be this way. So it starts to really change things. And what families need to understand is, you know, we have a responsibility that when we come home, it's not okay for us to treat everybody else like crap because we're having a bad day. But we don't own that. We just kind of go, that's just who we are. And we kind of just fill that space. But, you know, we need to step back for a moment and realize that until we share enough about our day and how it's affecting us and why it's affecting us, they're never going to understand why we're being a jerk. You know, if I came home and said, listen, I had this really bad call and I'm just going to give you the basics because I don't want to share too much with you. It really affected me for some reason. And then I said, I just need a little bit of time. They'll understand why you're being a jerk. They'll understand why you might be isolating for a little bit. Your emotions are all over the place. Why you need space 1 minute, the next minute you might be crying. Like if we shared more about what was going on and why it's affecting us, they would understand, you know, why we're being this way. And the problem is we don't trust anybody. You know, we have this major trust issue and, you know, we are starting to look at some of our new research is going back to the ACEs stuff. And it's like, everything that we are seeing is back there. That's where it starts. And it affects how we cope in life. It affects what we, I mean, literally every aspect of our life, how we cope, how we trust. We already have trust issues. And I believe we bring a lot of that with us. But it's like, if I share something with you, I tell them when I train, if I share something with you that's personal to me and that it's been weighing on me for a long time and I feel like, okay, this is the right moment, I'm going to share this. And at the next argument, you take what I shared and you throw it in my face, I will never share with you again. So you immediately stop whatever I was going to do. It will never move forward again and I will never share again because now you've again showed me that you can't be trusted. So then they stop trusting everyone. And now they become so like literally just they're self-isolating. Like they don't know who they can share stuff with. They don't know how much they can share. Even their friends at work, they know there's a limit on what you can share and what you can't share. It's just an unspoken rule. I mean, kind of as humans, most of us have that. Like, you know, when somebody's oversharing and you're like, oh my gosh, like that's just a bit too much information since I just met you. They know what that limit is. So they're scared to cross it. And what happens is they sit with it and they try to figure it out and they can't. So when they can't figure it out, they start drinking again. It's like back to this, it's like this vicious cycle.
So that trust factor is something that obviously has come up in so many conversations with other first responders. And that's where my area of research has been. And my dissertation work looked at that as well. And I think too, I'd love to hear your perspective, and your thoughts on where does protection come into that? Where is there this desire to also protect? I know just even from, I always say from my seat at the table, right? I'm picturing myself as a young girl at the dinner table and my dad just being totally disengaged. And I think a lot of that came from also this wanting to protect, right? The city that he worked in was pretty far from the town we lived in. And he did that really strategically. He didn't want us to really know what he saw on a day-to-day. He didn't want us to be part of that. And so from your view and your experience, where does that component come into it as part of the stressor for the first responder?
Well, you know, I always wonder why so many first responders pick this line of work. And again, I think it goes back to the ACEs thing. I think that there was some kind of trauma there, and there's, you know, there, and, you know, and it's really shown up in our data. So we have, you know, this narrative, which Dave Grossman calls, you know, we talk about the sheepdog being the officer. Mm-hmm. We talk about the wolf being the bad people, and we talk about the sheep being the people. And I think you get these young people who've had some kind of traumatic incident, event, whatever, that has really shaped them. They didn't feel protected. And they grow enough to go, okay, well, I'm not letting that happen again. And I will find that they gravitate towards these first responder roles because they have power now. They've, you know, and it really is. It's not just about protecting. It's about having power. They're taking that power back. And it can feel powerful to be able to do things that other people can't do, to hold, you know, have a gun. It's like those, you know, have arrest powers. Those are powers, but it's this protective thing they have. But we also noted in the data that there are also people here that wear the badge that shouldn't be here. And there are wolves in sheep's clothing, so to speak, or in sheepdog's clothing that are doing bad things that they shouldn't be doing. And again, we can go back to childhood and look at some of the things that have happened to them and go, holy cow, this lines right up with where we're at. Like, for example, in our Fatal 10, one of the components that we looked at were officers who were under investigation at the time that they had taken their lives. There was a small percentage that had been under investigation for an officer-involved shooting. They were merely waiting to be cleared. There was no wrongdoing noted. There was just, you know, they were just waiting for literally just things to happen, and they were going to move back into a space of going to work. But due to isolation, heavy drinking, a lack of support on and off duty, they weren't getting what they thought they needed. And sadly, it did not end well. But the majority in that, you know, Fatal 10 factor of being under investigation were sadly under investigation for child sex crimes. And I kind of sat there going, okay, I sat with it for a minute. I go, okay, this group is small, but it bothered me enough to go, wait a minute, how do you get someone who says they're going to serve and protect, and then you have someone that's literally a wolf among the sheepdogs doing these bad things to people? And it bothered me so much that I said, we've got to look into this. There's something bigger here. And we started looking into it. And there was a couple studies done where there had been over 1,000 cases pulled from outside people doing research. And I'm almost up to 1,000 myself right now with cases that include, you know, child sex crimes, pornography, whatever. And I just went, how could this be? You know, how could these people come in here trying to protect, and then they're doing exactly the opposite? And I found, again, they were blaming the job. A lot of them were blaming the job, saying the job was stressful. People didn't like cops. And I'm like, how does this even make sense? Right. And then, you know, we start kind of looking at that whole Fatal 10 a little bit differently, going, you know what? We have human problems.
I'd love to talk a little bit more, just circling back to this really valuable film that's out now to help bring awareness to these families that might be struggling, who maybe don't know why they're having such issues, or why it's this consistent battle of transitioning home from shifts, or just dealing with those day-to-day stressors in combination with this very stressful job. So talk to me a little bit about just the storytelling and the value of having this film, and where you see it being really beneficial for other first responder families. What is it really doing? It is such an impactful project. I had the absolute pleasure of learning more and more about the film and all of the stories that are incorporated in it. And I really believe that it's going to be really impactful. But tell me from your perspective, just being a part of it, what this is going to do for first responders and their families.
Yeah, I think one of the most impactful pieces, I think, for me, looking back at it, was the Ortiz family, was Deb, Michael, and Angela. When Michael shares his stories about how he kind of got where he is and how the drug use happened, the alcohol issues, you know, I think initially he really struggled with sharing that. You know, it was one of those things that carries a lot of shame, judgment, you know, it's just part of, you know, how these things play out. But I think the biggest part of that was explaining to him that, you know, there are other people struggling. And this isn't a story of, you know, all bad things. I mean, from this, they become a stronger family. They've been able to work through things. They've taken accountability, each one of them, for the pieces that they played in there. And they were able to come together as a family. And I think they've gotten stronger because of it. So it's like, just because people have things happening in their lives, like we all have things happening in our lives that other people don't know about. And we live with them a lot of times because it's shameful and we're scared that we're going to have, you know, there's judgment. What could happen if I reveal this? What are the repercussions? So people just sit there with it. And the longer you sit with it, the worse it gets. And I think this film just shows that you can have bad things in your life happen. You can be a part of that. You can even contribute to those things. And yet you can still come out on the other side even better for it. It just takes, you know, there's some steps that you have to take. You can't just hope for it. You have to actually have action behind it. And I think Deb and Michael and Angela show that in this film. It's just so well done. And I think the fact that they really own each of their pieces and they tell people that there is hope and things do get better.
How powerful to see an example of, because there's so many examples of it, of marriages failing and maybe, you know, issues with their children. And I know I'm one of two, so I have an older sister and just the four of us are different struggles and in different ways, right? Because everyone is, as a family system, everyone is dealing with it from a different lens and interprets exactly. things differently, right? So my view when I was 8 years old is going to be quite different than my sister who was older. And so my father coming home and ignoring and disengaging, to me, that meant something very different to my mother, right? Who was trying to kind of maintain the household and get dinner ready and drive us to 1600, you know, different activities after school and that sort of thing. And so there's so much power, I think, from what you're describing in the film of, yes, we know that these problems are there for first responder families. I know I do a lot of qualitative research, and something that a lot of specifically law enforcement will say to me is, you know, the jokes about having multiple spouses or multiple different kind of runs at marriage, or, you know, kind of you're not, I forget the running joke, maybe you'd probably know it, but something around, you know, you're not on your fourth spouse yet or something to that nature. So there's so much around this fixation of the kind of negative side of it. But I think what you're describing, the power of this film is that, yes, those things happen, but look what happens when you work on it. And here's examples of ways that families do come through it. And it doesn't define, and it doesn't mean that you have to go one specific route. It sounds like from the different stories that are kind of combined in the film too, those are all different stories, but they all have this, hey, we made it through and look at where we're at now. Am I hearing that correct?
Absolutely. And I think that's the one thing that we miss in law enforcement is we train officers every single day is to win, win, win. Every scenario we have to win.
Right.
And I said, there are days you wake up and you feel like a loser. I said, that's a sad reality. You wake up and you know that stuff's bad at home and you go to work and you do your job and you come home and it's the same old, same old. And anybody can feel like that. This isn't just about first responders. I mean, this is life. People struggle in life. And I think it's just easier for us because we have this kind of go-to excuse to say that this is the reason we have our issues. But this film really starts to empower people to say, you know, we all have issues. And I think it's like having a child who was abused. You know, you feel sorry and you want to help that child and get them the therapy and the help that they need. But at some point, they hit a threshold of becoming an adult. And if they abuse someone, you know, after that threshold, it's like there's no more feeling sorry at this point. Like we have to take some accountability here. And I it's the same kind of concept. Like you can have these issues, but when they start to become everybody else's issue, you have to take a moment and look at it.
And it sounds like that accountability piece is for the whole family too, right? That whole family system is saying, you know, this spouse of that first responder also having that conversation and the kids voicing that, right? I know it's hard as a child because to your point earlier, you don't know why they're coming home that way, right? I mean, especially as a young girl, I had no idea. My dad was Batman. If you asked me what I did for a living, he was Batman. Like there was being no stress. He was just, you know, perfectly invincible, which definitely plays into that kind of perception, right? That expectation.
Right.
And so now you have these different family members that are kind of struggling in different ways. And it sounds like that accountability component is not just for sure, partly on the first responder, but it's also on that family unit, right? Who are we beyond a first responder family and just a family sometimes too?
Yeah. I mean, are you enabling them to do this? Are you, are you part of the problem? Are you part of the solution? And I think, you know, everybody owns that. If you want them to get better and you want things to change, everybody has to own a piece of that.
Sure.
And Aaron, you know, you had talked about, you know, the kind of fighting for that marriage or that relationship. And I think, you know, as I stated earlier, we really are taught to fight, you know, and win every day at our job. But we don't teach our officers how to win at home. And I think I brought that up in the film too, is, you know, there should be a win-win here. You know, both sides should be getting what they need. But sadly, what happens is over time, when those relationships, they wear down, there's a lot of just distrust. There's a lot of even hate is a bad word to use. But there's a lot of that sometimes in relationships where you're just so upset with the other person because you don't feel like you're getting what you need, that this it starts to draw both people apart. And you really aren't wanting the best for each other. And neither one of you is really getting what you want anymore. So it's like, you know, I think we need to start teaching in our academies and in our agencies how to make that win-win at home. You know, there has to be this line of, you're not just winning to come home at work. Because if you come home and you live through something at work and you're going home somewhere that you don't feel is safe and stable and happy, what's the point? You're going to have officers putting themselves at greater risk at work because they may not want to go home. So we've got to make sure that we're teaching them how to win at both places.
Yeah, it sounds like, Dr. Johnson, too, that this notion of wellness kind of plays into that too. There's so many components of wellness that I think are pretty often overlooked. And I'm just talking across industries, right? We tend to focus on your health and your well-being, and we think of that as your physical, right? And starting to see some progression toward this like emotional, mental health. But very often, to your point earlier, that interpersonal relationship, connection, engagement, presence, right? Like being actually present with your family is not something that's talked about just across the board. We're not seeing that. But now looking at a profession like being a first responder, where it's even more important to take care of your wellness day to day because of the stress of the job, because of the trauma, those conversations sound so much more important than probably most departments are giving the attention to.
Yeah, I mean, wellness, we look at wellness as a component of safety. You know, if you're not in the game, you know, psychologically, physically, emotionally, you're putting everyone at risk, including yourself. And we see that across the board. So our Fatal 10 has really taken on a life of its own. So we're now looking at construction workers. And, you know, when we look at suicide among construction workers, you know, just their health and wellness in the day to day, they're putting themselves at risk in many of the things that they do, being in high places, you know, working alone. They have a lot of the same risk factors that our police officers do, but their means of suicide are different. Not much, but different. And they're more encompassing. But, you know, we have to look at a level of safety for people working and those around you. People that have an indifference to life and death, when we talk about suicide, or they have suicide, you know, ideations or whatever, they're not necessarily thinking about the safety of other people, let alone themselves. So they may inadvertently put people at risk. You know, our cops may be driving too fast for conditions, not wearing a vest, not wearing a seatbelt. You know, construction workers may not be using the proper equipment, the proper harnesses. They may put themselves at additional risk. And what, you know, they're not thinking at the time is they're not thinking about other people. They're probably not even thinking about their own families in that moment. They're so caught in that moment of being in distress or in crisis that they're not thinking clearly enough to be safe. And that's dangerous for everyone involved, not just them, but their coworkers and the community members around them.
Sure. And it sounds like to that point, there's just so many factors that when you get to that kind of feeling of there's not really a solution. And so you're no longer focused on these different elements. It becomes so difficult to even consider these other individuals, these other factors that might be involved in your kind of day to day. And so construction, we're seeing a lot of that to your point. And I think that a big piece of it too, just thinking back to that kind of concept of isolation. And, you know, if you think about law enforcement, yes, there's the camaraderie of the job and, you know, maybe going on other calls and there's other officers there. But I think the feeling of maybe not that strong sense of connection that maybe you would have if you worked in an office and you had conversations all day long, right? Or you had lunch together, or I don't know, fill in the blank, right? Construction, same thing. You kind of get to the job site and you just go and you do your work and you go home. And so there's not a ton of that kind of rapport building, relationship building that you might see in other industries, right? Where that kind of becomes a protective factor. And on top of it now, when you talk about that trust factor, and I know I'm backtracking a little bit, but when you really emphasize that trust component, that plays a role, right? For these types of professions where it becomes so important for them and almost a barrier to even be able to really connect on a level that probably maybe other people could relate to because of that. I don't trust that I'm going to protect myself. I'm going to protect the information because I don't know what the repercussions are of me sharing. But that fear becomes so impactful in decisions to kind of reveal or share more about themselves and what they're going through.
Yeah. And I think people give too much credit to the thin blue line, so to speak, and the brotherhood and the sisterhood. You know, again, we're people and we're going to have disagreements. We're going to have people in our agency we don't like. It is what it is. But I think everybody thinks that when we go to work, like everybody there are like best friends. We're going to barbecues every day at everybody's house. I'm like, that's not how it works. So I'm like, I really think that we take that for granted, thinking that that's really a protective factor, when the truth is that whole concept has really been in question for quite some time, at least for me. There's a lot of other issues going on. I mean, if you start pulling apart, what does this culture look like? You're going to have the same things that you have everywhere else. You're going to have a culture of bullying. Call it what you want. There's an undercurrent of it. There's going to be sexual harassment. There's going to be all kinds of things going on, just as there are in any other occupation. Mm-hmm. And yet, we kind of minimize that behavior and act like it's no big deal, like it's not really happening. And there are people in your agency that really don't feel like there's any connection to the people they work with. They go there, they do their job, they go home. So they're not really using that. Sometimes that's the opposite of a protective factor. That's something that's leading to their stress to begin with. The same thing can be said in construction. There's bullying. There are all kinds of things going on, harassment of people that maybe especially with males that see another male that may not be as masculine as they think that they should be, or they do something and they start to pick on that behavior or pull that behavior out. So it's the same things that we see other places. It's just people don't expect to see them in certain occupations. So it's hard to kind of wrap your mind around that it's like this little microcosm inside of each agency. There's so many things going on. And I think I put a post out recently that said, just because it's not happening to you and your agency doesn't mean it's not happening. And it's like, you could be struggling with something. You could be struggling with something that's, a racism issue, a sexism issue, a harassment issue, whatever it is, you could be struggling with that on your own and getting different treatment from other people. And yet, someone on your shift might not even know that you're dealing with it, or how bad it is, or that it even exists in your agency because it's not happening to them personally. So it's like, we don't quite understand the culture because it's just so weird. And it's so hard to understand unless you're in it. And each agency is unique to it, itself, and how the administrators react. And there's so many other components.
It sounds like too, there might even be those differences across teams and divisions. It's,
there's so many,
those layers. I'm just picturing like an onion. You're peeling back all of these layers. And yes, the outside might look a certain way. And, maybe leadership views it a certain way, but boots on the ground might kind of disagree, that sort of thing. And I feel like, to your point, just an extension of what you were saying, it's important to highlight too, those day-to-day messages. That's something I talk about a lot in the research space, is I explore what the reality of those messages are, right? Those messages where it's a pat on the back and they say, you're good, right? I mean, you're literally telling the person they have to be good. So the message to them is like, I better be good, right? There's no opportunity for me now to kind of, share and speak. And the more that, they hear mental health and how it's important and to talk about it, until you get down underneath like the reality of what the conversations actually sound and look like, it doesn't really matter if you're kind of promoting it once a month or saying that you have an EAP, because if those in-between moments that I always refer to, right, what goes on behind the scenes, if that conversation between peers is always like, oh, you're good, like, pick yourself up, you're fine, then offering services and offering support external to that, it's not going to hit, right? They're not going to be feeling like they can utilize it, because those messages day to day are the pure opposite. And so I don't know if that makes any sense in terms of what you were talking about, but I just feel like that came to mind of a lot of the work that I've done recently is exploring those messages. Like, what do you hear from your peers? What do you hear from the organization on the day to day? And it's pretty remarkable to see the difference between an agency wanting to promote health and wellness and do all of these things. But then when you look at the reality of the conversations day to day with their peers, it's kind of going against that. So so you're on this big kind of range of being helpful.
Yeah. And, you know, I think a lot of times, and this is just me personally speaking, those services are offered to check a box. It's a cover your ass. It's what, it's cover the agency. It's provide something. We have to do something. And I get that because you do have to provide something. But mm-hmm. I think after the check the box, provide something, they just don't know what to do. And, right. I think it's kind of and I can't blame all administrators either, because you can offer a million services. You can say it's completely confidential. Here is a number. You can call me directly. I will get you someone. And they will blame everybody in America why they can't call. And I'm like, you know, so we can't sit back and say, well, our administrators aren't doing enough either, because there are plenty of resources. I mean, I can't tell you how many resources we have. We have too many. In fact, we probably don't have enough time to vet as many resources that are out there saying they're helping first responders. And that's why I think we need to, you know, I feel like we're doing a lot of damage when we do things like, you know, we have these little slogans like smash the stigma. It's okay not to be okay. That's kind of our go-to now. Like that, I'm going to tell you that, and then I'm going to leave because I have no other options and no other resources for you. I think mm-hmm. we've gotten into a space where, because we don't have the right people there, nobody really knows what to do. And they're all running around scared. They're all doing the same training. They're telling you if you give your stuff away, you should be looking for this, you should be looking for that. And I'm like, we're missing the boat here. Like, we shouldn't even have people in crisis. So that's kind of where our research has changed the paradigm on this. Is we said, prevention and intervention methods do not work. The money we are spilling into prevention methods for suicide, you know, the dollars that we are putting in here are not getting the return on investment and saving lives at the record numbers that we need. Intervention is very dangerous. You're encountering people who are in crisis, may have a gun, may actually take other lives with them. I said, this is not working. Why do we wait until people are in crisis to actually do something? And that's what we're doing. It's like, well, here's the new number. Here's the 988 number. Here's this, here's that. I'm like, yes, but we're waiting for people to be in crisis. So we have changed the paradigm to where we're looking at what we call an inoculation paradigm. It's a model that says we keep people well so that they do not end up in crisis. And it's like a continuum. You're born, mm-hmm. you die. Along the way, you have ups and downs. And if we wait until someone is literally at crisis contemplating taking their life, we have missed the boat numerous times because they didn't get here overnight. Right? Something has happened along the way that has contributed to this, whether it's the stress and they can't deal with it appropriately. Maybe it's anxiety and everything that they face right now that you or I might think is everyday normal stuff. They take to heart and it makes them anxious and no one else understands them. And it's a buildup. And so we try to go back to those fatal 10. And we say, if these are the 10 things that are causing these issues, then we get to the front of those issues and we make your relationships healthy. We get to you as a young person. When we talk about drugs and alcohol, like, we know that the DARE programs don't work. We know that the money put into those programs have not worked for years, and yet the money keeps going. So why don't we stop for a moment and just like kind of look at all the stuff that's going on, all the money that's going out, and start making some different choices in how we educate our children, how we teach parents, how we teach educators, how we kind of change this whole outlook going forward. So in the next 20 or 30 years, we're not dealing with the same problems that we have today, you know, and yet we keep doing the same thing, expecting a different result, and nothing changes.
Yeah. And to your point, there's so much to unpack there, but to that kind of main point of looking at the individuals that you're trying to help, right? And what is their reality? What are they experiencing? And then how to kind of build from there. I think from your description and just our conversation thus far, there needs to be more focus on what's working, what's not. And if we know something's not working, that doesn't mean just put a Band-Aid on it, right? And right. Give some list of resources, but it's how do we shift? How do you kind of pivot from what was being done to learn? And I feel like that's where research comes in. You have to do the research. You have to talk to the people in the industry and really learn and use that to inform best practices moving forward.
And that's what we're doing. But I'll be honest with you, sometimes people don't want research. And sometimes people don't want that because it doesn't fit agendas and it doesn't fit the narrative that's going on. And that's what we're up against now, is like, we have answers, we have solutions, we have training that actually takes our fatal 10 and puts it into practice in the classroom. And yet, we're fighting against the same organizations getting the same grant money, doing the same training and getting the same result, which is nothing. And so we're fighting against some of these bigger organizations and we're saying, what do you have to lose other than another? Like, you have a lot to lose here. It's not just grant money. Like, we have lives at stake here and time is of the essence, but yet people don't want to try something new. And it's like, this isn't another slogan. Right. This isn't another, you know, just whatever. This is something that actually can be done in the classroom. It provides real tools, real skills. It gets people before they're in crisis. It helps manage their emotions. It helps manage things in their life that they may find difficult and have issues with. It does a triage of the fatal 10. What are the top things you're dealing with right now in your life? There's a whole like baseline test that we do. And yet when you present this, you would think I had three heads. And I'm like, you know, we can keep pulling people out of the river downriver, or we can stop them from even getting close to the river and jumping in the first place. And it's like, it's like so hard to get people to understand the mindset is stop operating in a disease model when we wait for people to get sick, because at some point, yes, they're going to go to the doctor and most of the time they're going to get fixed or healed or whatever. But at some point they're going to go and they're going to be told there is nothing more we can do for you. And we don't want that as your scenario. We want you to go to the doctor so that you stay well. And if you don't feel well, you go and you get fixed right away so that you're not dealing with something long term and not treating it. You don't have the disruptions in your life that are major that keep you down for days and weeks on end because you didn't take care of yourself. It's a maintenance program. And until we start thinking in that way, we're going to have a lot of sick people.
And that's a model just across industries that we're seeing. And now you're talking in a profession where, you know, there's already so much pushback and so many barriers and hoops and whatever, you know, fill in the blank that you want to, the term you want to use, but there's so much to fight through. And so just to kind of wrap up here, I know you've been absolutely incredible in just describing kind of what the main issues are and what you're facing. And as you're trying to really change the narrative, it sounds like, for so many first responders and their families, what are some next steps? What are things that are kind of your focus as you move forward to kind of shift? And I know that it sounds like such a large endeavor, but what are some key next steps, some key takeaways from our conversation today and ways that you're trying to kind of push forward in the work that you're doing?
Well, I think one of the big ones that we're starting to push is with agencies is stop rewarding bad behavior. You know, and that means, you know, start looking for those people that are doing things right. You know, for the number of suicides that we have, we still have thousands of officers that are doing things right. And they're having a career that's, you know, that runs 20 or 30 years and they're healthy and happy. They have ups and downs, but we need to start rewarding those people. What's happening is the whole tables are turning here where we're actually paying out on suicide deaths right now as line of duty in certain cases. And I think we're rewarding that behavior where we may have more, sadly, in the future. So we're trying to say, listen, let's look for the people that are doing things right and reward the good behavior, the healthy choices, you know, the self-accountability. They're still going to do things that aren't, you know, necessarily right. They'll get in trouble and they'll do certain things, but we got to start rewarding that good behavior so that we keep it happening over time. And, you know, I think just telling people that these are humans. We are all human. I mean, regardless of the occupation, you're going to have issues. And if you're not well and you're out on the job and you're doing things, you're not always going to make the best choices. And that's not to say that when you do something wrong, that you can start blaming the job for everything. You know, I think when we start taking some accountability for our actions, then we start to see that we have things to work on. And we all have things to work on. And I just want, you know, I want officers and first responders to know that I don't want you just to do a career or do your time here and then eventually go back home and hope for the best and hope that, you know, things work out. I want you to be happy and healthy, and I want you to enjoy what you've worked so hard for and what you've sacrificed for. And if you can't get on track now, it's not going to get on track by itself. So you've got to make some choices here to make that happen for you.
And help them kind of understand what strategies to utilize. And that's where I feel like resources, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's where I feel like the resources come in, is first teach and train and educate on, this is a physiological response. This is a human thing. This is not a you problem. This is normal reactions to these things. And so here are some strategies, here are some tools. Once you understand that and can kind of take ownership and accountability over that.
Yeah, you got to normalize that what they're going through. And then not only that, it's make the first call. One of the biggest things that first responders do is they'll get a number and they're like, shit, what am I supposed to do with that? And then they're scared mm-hmm. to make the first call because they don't know what's going to happen. It's the fear of the unknown. Right. When you go to work, I know that when I go to work, I'm carrying a gun. I got my stuff could happen. I know that. That's not, you know, of course you'd be scared if you're involved in something, but you know that that's a possibility. If somebody hands you a number and says, here, here's a resource for you, you are scared to death when you need that because you don't know what's going to happen. And I, you know, I'm always like, you know, listen, the worst thing that can happen is that you get help. I mean, seriously, you get help. You know, you don't have to go through your agency to use a lot of these resources. Mm-hmm. And you can do this on your own and no one's going to find out. You just have to have enough trust in someone that's going to walk you through this. And I'll get on the line with you and we'll talk, you know, we'll talk our way through it. You call and you tell them, hey, I'm calling for a friend. Whatever you need to do the first time, do that the first time. And I think once we talk to them and tell them exactly what's going to happen when you make those calls or you call a clinician or you set something up, what do you need to tell them? You break down that fear in little pieces that they can now manage. And if you can't get them past the first hurdle, they're never going to get past any other ones. And that's probably the largest one that they face.
Sure. So that feeling of a lack of control, right? When you are struggling yes. with anything, you just feel like you're not in control of any part of it. So it sounds like what you're saying is, you're putting them back in the driver's seat. You're putting them back in that feeling of control. I can at least, I'll know what's happening next sort of thing. And you've been fantastic. Thank you so much for your time and your just, you know, depth and breadth of what you're sharing, I think is just so important and needed as part of this conversation. And I know the film is fantastic. So many people are going to benefit from that. And we'll put up the link to that as well. But just want to thank you so much for you're so incredibly insightful. And I think it's so powerful to hear someone who has had experience in the field and is now dedicating your, you know, career at this point to how do we move forward? Where are the gaps? How to fill those gaps? And I think, you know, just from your passion coming through the conversation, I feel it just on the other side of the computer. And I know that you are someone who's going to kind of push back on the pushback, so to speak, right? You're not taking that for an answer. And I think we need more people like that.
I appreciate that. Yeah, I love my first responders and I'll fight for them every single day.
Thank you so much. And thank you for your time. And like I said, we'll put up some links to all of Dr. Johnson's incredible work and the film, of course. And I just want to thank you for being part of the U-Turn Health podcast. We really appreciate your time.
I appreciate the platform. Thank you.